In hindsight, all great ideas are obvious. The big ideas of today will become market-leading companies in the near future, reimagining every sector of the economy for the better. Climate, healthcare, food, transportation, housing, energy, and more. Welcome to Obvious Ideas, a podcast exploring the transformation of the fundamental building blocks of life and society. I'm Andrew Beebe, Managing Director at Obvious Ventures. This is episode 8 of our 8-part series on climate. We're digging into the biggest opportunities for founders and professionals in any industry to tackle our climate crisis. Today, we're speaking with Kathy Zoid, the CEO of EVgo, America's largest fast charging network for electric vehicles. She's been a leader in climate for over 3 decades, previously serving as chief of staff in the White House Office of Environmental Policy during the Clinton administration, and as a director at the US EPA, where she pioneered the Energy Star program. During the Obama administration, she oversaw over $30 billion in energy investments. Kathy also co-founded Odyssey Energy Solutions and served as CEO of Sun Edison's Frontier Power, the Alliance for Climate Protection, and the Sustainable Energy Development Authority in Australia. In this episode, Kathy shares the biggest misconceptions people have about EVs and what it will take for electric vehicles to take over entirely. Welcome, Kathy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's just start at the top with what you've been up to over the last few years. What is EVgo and what exactly are you doing today?
Yeah, EVgo is the most expansive public fast charging network in the United States. We build, own, and operate these fast chargers all over the place. And our mission is to do this so that we can accelerate transportation electrification. We've got, you know, a once-in-a-century opportunity here as we're, you know, addressing climate by electrifying vehicles and also creating vehicles that are really fun to drive. And all of the research suggests that without abundant, convenient, reliable charging services, drivers are going to remain hesitant. So we're out there fixing that.
What is fast charging?
So the way we're going to charge all of these different kinds of vehicles, it's kind of an ecosystem of solutions. So a fast charger is where you're going to get maybe 150 miles of range in your car in 15 minutes or so. Again, that's going to vary depending on the car and vary on the particular kind of fast charging. You could just plug your electric vehicle into the same outlet that your electric toothbrush is plugged into, and it would take you somewhere between 24 and 36 hours to recharge your battery. And then there's the level two, which is right in between. Basically, you get 150 miles of range in maybe 4 to 6 hours. So what we specialize in is that really convenient on-the-go fast charging while you're grocery shopping.
That's a super helpful spectrum there. I actually installed, because I'm an energy nerd, I installed my first level two charger a decade ago on the side of my own home. And now, you know, for that last decade, I've been charging a car overnight and I don't really think about it. I come home, I plug in, I wake up, the car is ready to go, just like we do with our iPhones. But what you're talking about is I'm on the road or I'm taking a long road trip and I need to pull over and charge up. And I should be able to do that in 15 minutes, at least to get me the next leg of the trip. Is that the general concept here?
Well, yes. And the and is that while you have a garage where you can conveniently charge every night, 30% of Americans don't have that. And so what we want, our objective is to have everybody driving an EV, right? If you don't have access to home charging, then you need to be able to charge conveniently away from home. And so being able to do it while you grocery shop or while you take your kids to the park or while you go to the gym or while you get a manicure, that's what fast charging is for people who don't have access to home charging. Now, in addition, of course, if you're going to see your in-laws that are a couple hundred miles away and you need to stop for a charge, yeah, you definitely want that to be fast. The other thing is that people, you know, may or may not be aware of is that there are lots of people who drive for a living. So even if they have at-home charging, during the course of the day, they might need a quick charge away from home. Rideshare drivers, for instance. You've got Uber and Lyft that have both made commitments to going zero emission by 2030. Increasingly, you're going to be getting into Ubers and Lyfts that are EVs. And those guys drive a couple hundred miles a day. So they need to charge quickly away from home. And they like to do it on their lunch break. So that's why, you know, EVgo, we like to build our chargers right near fun stuff to go eat.
There is one of your charging stations now right next to an In-N-Out in our neighborhood.
Told ya.
And I've definitely thought about taking advantage of both of those simultaneously. I mean, I'm sure there are a number of reasons why these aren't everywhere and your network isn't on every single corner. And some of that has to do with build out, but some of it has to do with cost. When I did my home installation of my level 2 charger, it was something like $300 and a couple of trips to Home Depot. What you do is quite different. So could you just explain, why are these things so darn expensive?
Yeah. So it sounds like what you did, Andrew, all by yourself, which I wouldn't necessarily recommend, is you installed effectively a dryer outlet by yourself, right? That's what your $300 is. Most people, when they have a level 2 charger installed in their garage, will spend somewhere between $1,000 and $3,000. It has additional gadgets. It has some weatherproofing. It has some sub-metering and that sort of thing. When workplaces put level 2s in their parking garages, typically it's a $3,000 to $5,000 per charge port cost. EVgo, when we put in a fast charging stall that's capable of giving you 150 miles of range in 15 minutes, that's $130,000 per charging stall. It's 2,000 components. It's lots of power. It's not just an installation project. It's a construction project. It's sophisticated equipment. It's basically kind of a little power plant, right? So that's the absolute cost. But that's what you get is a premium product, which is you get a lot of kilowatt hours dispensed into your battery really, really quickly.
Are you witnessing those prices come down, or is there not some massive scale cost reduction curve going on there?
Well, look, as an energy technology aficionado like me, we all have seen experience curves, right? We will see the same thing. When I got to EVgo, you had 50 kilowatts was sort of the bottom of the line fast charger. Then there were 150 kilowatts. A couple of years later, the 150 kilowatt chargers were the same cost as the 50 kilowatts because of that experience curve. And when we talk about kilowatts, that represents the maximum amount of power that the car can take at any moment in the charge. So the higher the number, the more electrons are going to be going into the battery at that moment. Now, our standard configuration is 350 kilowatts. Right? That's faster. That's more powerful than any light-duty vehicle can actually take a charge right now. But we're doing the Wayne Gretzky thing and skating ahead of the puck because we know those higher power cars are coming. And again, over time, we expect those costs to come down on those 350 kilowatt chargers. They require liquid-cooled cables. It's a lot of power. The only wrinkle in that recently is COVID and supply chain issues. So we were on kind of that classic Moore's law, watch it come down with volume until the world decided to sort of have a pandemic and then Russia invaded the Ukraine. And now we're kind of in this, everybody's having trouble getting everything. But we would expect post these crises that exactly the same experience curve will be witnessed.
On the horizon over the next 5 years, are there any step functions in that curve net of all the supply chain where you might see a 20%, 50% reduction, or is it really just like the way crystalline solar panels got cheaper and cheaper and cheaper?
As far as the current configuration of when you see a fast charger, that's going to be that kind of incremental improvements over time as just the components get cheaper, the industrial engineering gets better. We may see wireless charging become commercial. Like we've got wireless charging at a lab scale now, and that's for level 2 to do wireless fast charging. It was demonstrated in May at the ACT Expo, which is sort of like the Woodstock for clean transportation. So people are talking about it. It's not yet commercial or at scale. That might be different. Now, that might actually be more expensive. I don't know. There's obviously sort of different potential technologies that can enter the fray. And EVgo happens to be technology agnostic. So we keep our eyes open for any of those things. And if there is a cost-effective, reliable charging technology that is available, we will bring it into our portfolio.
Net of supply chain, are there other things out there that are really slowing this scale that everybody wants to have happen tomorrow?
Well, the capital intensity of fast chargers means that the way we make money as a builder, owner, operator is there are enough EVs on the road. So when everybody's driving an EV, it's an absolutely clear-cut business, you know, where revenues can exceed costs. In these early days, if what we need to do is build ahead of when those cars are on the road, then we need other folks to come to the party to help pay for that. So we've got like their state grant programs. The Biden infrastructure money is going to be helpful at building that bridge between what's not quite commercial today and what will be when there are many more EVs on the road. EVgo has partnerships with OEM. So we have a, for example, a $90 million partnership with General Motors, where GM's paying us basically a third of the cost of the CapEx to build ahead of demand in new cities where they intend to sell EVs.
And OEM means original equipment manufacturer, typically referring to the major car manufacturers.
Right. So that's sort of on the cost side, bringing those parties together to create a commercial proposition. That takes some time, but we now have a whole lot of pipeline for getting that done. Then when it comes down to actually building a station, we don't own the land. So what we do is we talk to a site host, a grocery store operator. We say, how would you like to have fast charging in your parking lot so people can charge while they shop? They say, oh, we'd love that amenity because we need to get people back to the stores. So that's all great. We say, okay, now the standard that we build is 350 kilowatt chargers. And we'll check with the utility, but that might require a local utility to upgrade the service to that parking lot. I said, well, all right. If that's going to happen, the utility then needs to get an easement from the landlord to be able to access that equipment that they then own because it's part of the local distribution grid. So that takes a little bit of time. So that's on that front end. The utility has to approve our engineering and the design of it. That takes a little bit of time. The local government authority has to say, yes, we approve of this EVgo station in this parking lot. That can take anywhere from a couple of weeks to many months in certain jurisdictions across the country that like to actually approve each of the plants that's going to be near this chargers. I mean, it's a wide variety. So while it takes EVgo about 4 to 8 weeks to construct the station, it historically has taken about 18 months to get from idea of building a fast charging station in a parking lot to energization and inspection by the utility so that cars could start to charge there. Now, we're making progress. Like, we've got some utilities that are moving really fast. We've got some site hosts that have said, we don't need an easement, but we will grant the utility access when they need to look at the equipment. So there's a whole bunch of little things to play whack-a-mole to sort of bring that time frame down.
And hopefully templatize.
Exactly. You remember when we did this in solar, right? In the early days when you wanted to do rooftop solar, I mean, you and I probably both experienced this on the peninsula in the Bay Area. It took a long time, but now the local governments have experience with it. And hopefully it's just, oh, yeah, solar, here you go, stamp.
Pretty much over the counter these days. And so, yeah, that's progress. And now we can see the scaling numbers are just extraordinary in that domain. And so coming back to the cost just for one last second, Tesla did something incredible with the supercharger network early on. Is there anything about the design of those chargers that's substantially cheaper or different, or is it just sort of modeled for their cars, but still expensive?
It's modeled for their cars, and it doesn't have to have a credit card reader because it's made only for the walled garden of Teslas. So there's bells and whistles that charging companies like EVgo are required to have because we are charging all cars. We have ADA requirements to make sure that people with disabilities can access them. When you're having a private network, as Tesla does, it's not subject to some of those same requirements. With that said, Tesla has created a beautiful, seamless charging experience for Tesla drivers. I mean, it really is the standard of what the others of us are in the field are trying to create for drivers of other kinds of EVs. So that you can drive up, that you can just plug in, that we have your information. It's a great user experience.
Kathy, what are the biggest misperceptions people have about EVs?
What do people have as a misconception? That they won't be able to charge it easily? People feel like there isn't a price point. They think of like Teslas are really expensive, therefore an EV isn't for me.
So speaking of which, I was driving around the Bay Area the other day in zip codes where the penetration of EV is very high. In one day, I counted 10 different brands, not just 10 different models, but close to 10 different brands, including like the Mini Cooper and the Leaf. I saw some Polestars. I saw some Rivians, which were very exciting. I saw Lucid Air, which I had not seen before. And of course, a lot of Teslas all over the place. So that beautiful breadth of offering that everybody's been talking about for a long time was starting to manifest, even on the truck side, and the F-150 is really just emerging. So there's a lot of exciting stuff going on the vehicle consumer choice side. Yet, when you look at Bloomberg's numbers and others who I think are, you know, ambitious or on the cutting edge of posting big forecasts, 5 years from now, I think we're still talking about less than 50% of those passenger vehicles of new sales being EV. What would you attribute that constraint to? Is it price or choice or just sluggishness? Like, is there anything that you think could really accelerate? And what role do charging networks have for that?
Yeah, look, I think the place that's tipped over 50% is Norway. And you sort of say, why? And again, there were lots of policy interventions that made it more financially sensible to buy an EV in Norway than less, than to buy a new internal combustion engine vehicle. And this is an economy whose sovereign wealth fund has been derived from fossil fuels. So how about that? There is support for zooming through toll booths and everything else if you have an EV. So living in Norway with an EV is nicer than living in Norway with an internal combustion engine. And that's why they've been able to accelerate deployment. So the same things will truly happen here if we have the same sets of incentives. With that said, we're later in the development process. So just what you've observed driving around the Bay Area, the car companies have announced that it's going to be in the next 24 months, there's going to be 50 different models of EVs available. So if you want a pickup truck that's an EV, you got it. If you want a little tiny teeny weeny thing, you got it. If you want an SUV, a crossover, any shape and size of car that you like, you will be able to get it very soon in an EV model. I think that just the abundance of choice will accelerate the take up of EVs. And I guess the surprise, which is lemonade coming out of a very bad situation, is that with oil prices going up because of Russia having invaded the Ukraine, the most common Google search in the United States over the past few weeks was actually people looking for EVs because gas prices went up and they said, well, this is silly. Now is the time for me to find an EV. Now, at the moment, there's a shortage of supply of EVs. You know, they're all selling over MSRP. Again, I am hoping that that will be a temporary phenomenon and that things will settle down. And by later this year and early into next year, we'll have an abundant supply of EVs. But right now, this year, every single EV that can get manufactured is going to get sold. It'll probably get sold over its asking price.
Let's say we do accelerate and things just go really well. And 5 years from now, we do hit 50% of all new vehicle sales are electric. Have you predicted or thought about the potential downsides of that and things we might have to address along the way? You know, people talk about fire risks in Northern California and you don't have a fully charged vehicle and the power goes out. People talk about strain on the grid, et cetera.
One of my former colleagues noted that the most exciting thing that's happened to electric utilities since the invention of the central air conditioner is the forthcoming EV revolution. So the utilities that were not necessarily super excited about solar in the early days are actually really excited about EVs. But it requires planning. It well and truly requires the modernization of the local grid, particularly when we get to charging of medium and heavy duty. Right. Like, so in the old days, when EVgo would put 150-kilowatt or 250-kilowatt chargers in a grocery store parking lot, easy. The existing local network could handle that. Now that we're doing 6 350s in one location, we need a service upgrade. When you start charging 18 buses and you're talking about 3 megawatts, you actually have to be working hand in glove with the utility. There's no question that the utilities need to be involved in this to make sure that the local grid can handle it. But there's also no question that that can be done.
I had our good friend Jigar Shah on this podcast a while back, and he was making sort of that point exactly, just saying that the grid that we have today will not survive the onslaught of electric vehicles, particularly large-scale, heavy-duty electric vehicles, over the next decade without pretty radical overhauling, maybe at the transmission level, but most definitely at the distribution level.
That sounds like Jigar was making a negative comment, like it's all going to fall apart. I actually just think it's the modernization that we've been waiting for a long time. It's an investment in more localized generation, in two-way power flows. I mean, like, look, I'm really excited about the possibility of having my EVs in my garage being my backup for when we do have those storm events, right? I don't need to install a power wall at home anymore. My car battery is my power wall.
And that was front and center in Ford's messaging, something that they had clearly tested carefully and decided this was really a selling point.
Yeah. Well, but it's right. It's a lot of batteries.
You have been doing this for a while, and I've known you a lot of that time. And we have seen different levels of entrepreneurs and interest from young people coming into this space. And I guess my observation is that I have never seen anything like this in terms of the excitement from particularly people just coming out of school, but of all generations trying to find ways to have an impact on climate, but many of them stumble a little bit. What advice do you have for people who are trying to make their way over to climate tech? How do you get into this industry?
I'll just speak for EVgo. We need skills of all types. we need marketing people. We need hardware engineers. We need software engineers. We need clear thinkers who can actually come up with revenue models, because there's no lather, rinse, repeat on how to make money in doing what we do. We need policy experts that can help us sort of come up with model plans for local government so that this isn't so hard. We need people who are smart, who are committed, who are hardworking and creative. And it doesn't even matter what their backgrounds are. EVgo has, during COVID, we more than doubled in size. My first question to every single one of our new employees, you know, and it's supposedly a really hard market to hire people. We don't seem to be having much trouble. So why were we so lucky to get you? Why did you choose EVgo? Without exception, in the past 12 to 18 months, it has been, I want my work to have an important mission. It could be helping to solve climate change. It could be, I love clean transportation. It could be, I love EVs because they help clean up. I want to be able to tell my children I'm doing something that's meaningful. But consistently, the mission orientation matters. And these are really talented people that have an abundant number of choices and have come from places where, which didn't necessarily have that overlay of public policy outcome with good business.
That resonates so well with something that Yetming Chang at MIT said to me. I asked him what the kids coming in as 18-year-olds at MIT, freshmen, what were they excited about? What did they want to study? And he said, 50% are there to study climate change. And I said, okay, but what about the other 50%? And he said, well, they're in two groups. 50% want to do robotics and the other 50% want to do computer science. But both of those groups want to do those two things to solve climate change. So he was very optimistic about the future state of graduates coming out of MIT, and I'm sure many of them will head in your direction. We're going to end with one question that we ask everybody on the show as we wrap up, and it is the following. In hindsight, all great ideas are considered obvious. Come 2030, what are we going to look back at as an obvious idea that today seemed totally crazy?
Well, I have one that might be a little unpopular. Environmentally sound desalination of ocean water. I think we can do this. I have a ranch in Ojai. Ojai's history has been one of agriculture. Oranges, avocados, pretty thirsty sorts of crops. And climate has already taken its toll. And the guys that have been here for generations say, we can't grow these things here anymore. So on my ranch, we're growing agave. We're growing passion fruits. We're growing more drought tolerant, but we still need some water. And I do believe that we can, in an environmentally sound way, with using renewable energy, desalinate water so that vast stretches of America can remain habitable and can remain lovely. It hasn't been done on a wide scale basis in the United States. It's not like a new crazy tech. It's a technology that's known, but for some reason, there's a lot of resistance to it. But I think it's world changing if we can get our heads around it.
I agree. And I would imagine in 8 years looking back, people will say, gosh, why weren't we doing this a long time ago? Because as you said, the technology's been around, but we've just had some implementation challenges. Kathy, every time I talk to you, I learn a ton. So thank you so much for coming on this podcast. It's great to see you from a distance and great to talk through these really important issues. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thanks, Andrew.
That was Kathy Zoi, CEO of EVgo. Next week on the show, we're flipping the script for a special bonus conversation. Emily Brady, editorial director at Obvious Ventures, will be interviewing me about my biggest takeaways from this season. And of course, the obvious ideas of the future that may seem crazy today.
You don't have to go get a nuclear physics degree at MIT to go follow this path, especially decarbonization. It will touch every corner of the global economy.
Obvious Ideas is produced by Obvious Ventures in partnership with Pod People. Obvious invests in purpose-driven founders reimagining trillion-dollar industries. To learn more about us and where we invest, head to obvious.com. Special thanks to our production team, Gabe Kleiman, Aniko Steffen, and Emily Brady from Obvious, and the team at Pod People, Rachel King, Amy Machado, Emily Shaw, Madison Lusby, and Jason Mack. I'm Andrew Beebe. Thanks for listening.